Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. The rise of China as an economic powerhouse and a massive consumer of resources such as oil and copper over the past decade has been extraordinary. And if you want to know where the global economy is headed, you need to keep China front and center in your view. And the story of China is so big and the methods for measuring it so new and subject to the usual conflicts of interest between and among the reporting parties that really our best hope of understanding what is going on and where things are headed is to take a macro view and look at how things are balanced, or not, across the entire economy. Fortunately, today we are joined by China expert Michael Pettis, who has the best grasp of the macro storylines for China that I know of. Michael is a Beijing-based economic theorist and financial strategist and is currently a professor of finance at Peking University in Beijing. And Michael and I, we met this past April when we both presented at the Wine Country Conference in Sonoma, California. There, I found his insights and forecasts on China some of the most astute I've ever heard, and I'm very pleased that he's joined us today to discuss China's present and future. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, you recently wrote in a Financial Times piece that China's main task is to rebalance its economy, and that this rebalancing will pretty much guarantee that its rate of economic growth is going to slow down. What is this rebalancing? Why must it happen? And why will it assure a slower rate of growth?
Well, in order to understand the story of China, it's important to start with the recognition that, you know, contrary to much of what we've been hearing in the last few years, there's nothing particularly unique or extraordinary about what's happening within the economy. Certainly, China has grown at a tremendous rate in the last 30 years, but lots of countries have had investment growth miracles, maybe not as long as China and maybe not as profound as China's has been, but there's quite a lot that we can learn about what is happening in China from looking at previous experiences. And it turns out that the Chinese growth story is one we've seen many times before, and it typically starts out very well. The story begins with a period in which the country, in this case China, has tended to be systematically underinvested. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, China had no roads, no airports, no manufacturing capacity. Its economy had been pretty much decimated between the period of the anti-Japanese war and then the first two or three decades of communist leadership. So what China really needed was a significant increase in investment to raise its productivity level, and in fact, that's what happened. We saw investment grow very rapidly during this period, and with all of that increased investment in manufacturing capacity, investment in infrastructure, et cetera, with all of that investment, we saw very, very strong, very robust growth take place in the Chinese economy. But the problem that this model has always faced is that after many years of investment, two things happen. First, the political and economic system gets built around this constantly increasing level of investment. And secondly, we move from a period in which it's fairly easy to identify economically viable projects. Basically, China didn't have anything and could use a little bit of everything, to a period in which investment levels are so high. China has the highest investment rate ever recorded and the highest growth rate of investment probably ever recorded, that we start to run out of economically viable projects. But because the system is so geared towards continuous increases in investment, we keep on investing. And when that happens, investment is misallocated into projects that don't generate sufficient real returns on a social basis. And so since these investments are funded by debt, one of the consequences is that automatically you find debt growing faster than debt servicing capacity, which of course is unsustainable. This, by the way, has happened to every single country that's followed this growth model, so it shouldn't be a big shock to us that it's happening to China, too. And the problem is that we've been doing this for so long, I think, in retrospect, we'll probably look back and see China as the most extravagant period of overinvestment ever seen, exceeding even Japan in the 1980s, that the result has been that debt levels in China are extremely high. So all of this talk about rebalancing the Chinese economy is basically a recognition of this factor. We can no longer count on investment to drive growth because investment is being misallocated. But unfortunately, the economy is so dependent on investment that if you bring investment levels down, which you have to do if you want to address the debt problem, then you also bring growth down very significantly. And we've just started to see the process. Investment hasn't come down. It hasn't even really slowed that dramatically. It's slowed a little bit. And growth rates dropped from roughly 10%, which is where they were before 2008, 2009, to around 7% today. And I suspect they're going to drop an awful lot more before this process stops.
Well, the normal sector that would then be expected to pick up and fill in for the investment portion would be household consumption. Where is household consumption in China today?
Well, household consumption in China is probably the lowest ever recorded in times of peace, which is another way of saying that China's savings rate is the highest ever recorded. Now, we normally think of savings as a good thing, but savings is just postponed consumption, and the purpose of economic growth is to generate increases in consumption. So the problem that we have in China is that consumption is so low, savings so high, that it's very hard for consumption to generate, for growth in consumption to generate a great deal of GDP growth. So we want growth in consumption to replace growth in investment as the generator of growth, but that's going to be very hard to do. Now, one of the big misconceptions about China is the nature of Chinese savings. China has the highest savings rate possibly ever recorded. And people say, well, you know, it's quite easy to solve that problem. When people save too much, all you have to do is, however, convince them to reduce their savings rate, increase their consumption rate, and there the problem is solved. But that's a fallacy, and that's based on our mistaken belief that savings are equal. Savings are caused by household savings. But no, there are three parts of the economy that save: the household sector, the government sector, and the business sector. And all of them save at quite high rates, which is why overall savings is so high. So how do you bring consumption up? Well, it turns out the reason consumption in China is so low is not because Chinese don't like to consume. You've only to visit any city in China and you'll see the Chinese are as eager to consume as anybody else. The problem in China, though, is that all of this very rapid growth was generated by these hidden transfers from the household sector to subsidize growth. In other words, wages grew too slowly, although they have grown quickly. The currency has been undervalued, which is like a tax on consumption. And most importantly, interest rates were set extraordinarily low, which is like a tax on household savings. All of these things have generated rapid growth, but they did so at the expense of the household sector. So household income grew much more slowly than GDP. So the household share of the economy has contracted to the point where at roughly 50%, it's probably the lowest ever recorded for any large economy. The exceptions are, you know, one or two oil sheikdoms that have their own distortions. So if you want consumption to grow as a generator of growth for the economy, what you're asking for is for household income to grow as a generator of growth for the economy. In other words, instead of contracting as a share of GDP, you want household income to expand as a share of GDP. And therein lies the big problem, because if you eliminate all of those transfers, those hidden taxes, then you also eliminate the source of growth. More importantly, for many years, while China was growing quickly and the household sector was growing a little bit less quickly, the state sector was growing more quickly, and that generated tremendous benefits for the political elite. And so rebalancing in China means that the household share has to grow, which is another way of saying that the state share has to contract. And perhaps not surprisingly, that is going to be strongly resisted by many members of the political elite, which is why the problem that China faces today, the rebalancing problem, is primarily a political problem more than it is an economic problem.
So it's really a shift of wealth and therefore power. And if I have this story right, then for the household income to go up, you can do just a couple of things are your big levers. One, you can raise interest rates on deposits. Of course, that is going to raise the cost of capital. That slows the economy down. Or you can have income go up, which means wages go up. And that's part of the economic miracle story, is keeping wages low so that there's a competitive advantage. Is that roughly right?
Exactly right. In fact, they're all related. There's a third thing you can do, and that is raise the value of the currency. Mm. Remember that if the currency appreciates, that eliminates this hidden consumption tax, and it makes imported goods cheaper. So it makes the real value of household income go up. So you can do all of these things, but if you raise the currency, that helps the household sector, but it undermines the export sector. If you raise wages, that helps the household sector, but it undermines employers as a group. And most importantly, if you raise interest rates, this has been the key distortion, if you raise interest rates, that helps the household sector because they get a much better, a fair return on their existing savings. But of course, that is very, very painful for the borrowers. And there's so much debt in China, and it's not even clear that a lot of the borrowers can pay the debt at the existing very low interest rates. So if you were to raise interest rates to whatever the right level ought to be, you would probably see a surge in insolvency. So it's a pretty tough problem to resolve.
Well, it sounds, has echoes, of course, elsewhere in the world, where a rise in interest rates would be very unwelcome in many a sovereign state at this particular point in history. So where are we in this story then? It sounds a little bit like a potential stalemate because there's so many competing interests, all of which are very powerful. How is this story beginning to resolve, or is there any clarity around which of these big levers is going to be the one that's going to be pulled?
Well, we're right in the middle of the process. The good news is that the current leadership, perhaps unlike the previous leadership, is pretty determined to get their arms around the problem rather than simply kick it down the road a bit longer. Now, this may be for the right reasons, or it may simply be because debt levels have risen so quickly that they are understandably concerned that if they don't fix things, we run the risk of running into a debt crisis. Whatever the reason, the new leadership under Premier Li Keqiang seems pretty determined to try to constrain the growth in credit. But it's not an easy thing, and the jury is out. We don't really know. There hasn't been a significant slowdown in credit. What's happened is that the growth rate of credit has slowed down, and already we've seen that's had a big impact on GDP growth rates. This has to continue, and it is going to be strongly resisted. So it's not very clear to me yet what's likely to happen, but I would say as a rule of thumb, if you see growth rates in China much above 4 or 5%, you can almost be certain that debt is continuing to rise at an unsustainable pace. It's going to take much lower growth rates before we can be reasonably confident that they've got their arms around the debt problem.
Now, we saw, I think, some early salvos of this with the overnight lending rates that really spiked. Is that part of this story? Was that an attempt to constrain this credit growth, and by putting out a message, or was there something else going on there which portends something more frightening, such as a liquidity freeze that could have rippled through the banking system?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. On the one hand, the central bank under the guidance of the State Council, because the central bank is not independent, the central bank has wanted to slow down credit creation, and they were willing to see interest rates go up as part of that process. But I think what happened on July 20, when we had the credit crunch, came as a big surprise to everybody. I think there was even a little bit of panic in the markets. And the reason for that, and I think we're going to see more of these kind of things, is that we've reached the stage where a lot of credit growth consists simply of borrowing to repay existing principal and interest. So if you allow interest rates to go up, that doesn't necessarily slow down the demand for credit because the borrowers desperately need the money in order to repay earlier loans. It's not as if they're borrowing money to invest in productive facilities. So this demand for credit is going to stay very, very strong, and any attempts to slow it down may end up causing pretty significant disruptions within the money markets. So this isn't the first disruption we've seen. It's the first big one that was widely noticed around the world. But we've seen these before, and we're likely to see them again. The system is very tightly wound up around the need to create credit, and it's going to be very hard to wean it off that need.
So certainly there's a very large economic risk that can happen if you do run into that credit crunch. That's something that I think is also, we could look historically and say these things happen when you have malinvestment and you have credit growth that's exceeded the underlying rate of economic growth, and you're just now rolling over new credit to pay off past credit. That is a knife edge, and it's fraught with some economic risks, even, you know, some fairly significant systemic financial risks as well. Socially and politically, what are the risks that exist in if this system really does hit a wall of some kind?
Well, it's always tough to predict the downside because the downside is infinite. You can always mismanage a crisis. But in principle, we don't really need to see a great deal of social dismay if there is a rebalancing of the economy. My own expectations are that over the presidency of Xi Jinping, the 10-year period, it's very hard for me to figure out how, just arithmetically, the country can rebalance at growth rates that average much above 3-4%. So I consider that to be the upper limit of growth over this decade, more now and less later. Now, a lot of people will tell you, well, if that happens, we run the risk of significant social disturbance and even political crisis within China, because we keep hearing over and over again that 8% growth is the minimum amount of growth required to keep the population happy. This 8% number is sort of nonsensical. It's not really clear where it came from. But it's also the irrelevant number. People don't care about GDP per capita. People care about their own income. So instead of focusing on very high levels of GDP growth, what we really need to be concerned about is how do you keep household income growth high? Now, rebalancing, by definition, means that household income must grow faster than GDP. So if GDP grows at 3-4%, as I expect it to, or what I think is the upper limit, but household income grows at 6-7%, I would argue that not only is China achieving the necessary rebalancing, but there's no reason why ordinary people, ordinary Chinese households, should be unhappy with growth rates of 6-7%. That's pretty close to what they've been experiencing in the last 20 to 30 years, and by any standards, that's a great number. The trick is, how do you get household income, after many years in which household income grew more slowly than GDP, how do you get household income to grow more quickly than GDP? It can be done. If you look at Japan, which had a similar problem to China in the 1980s, although not as extreme, after 1990, Japan's GDP grew by roughly 0.5% on average, but household income grew by about 1.5-2%, which when you throw in deflation and a declining population, suggests that the Japanese households didn't perform nearly as badly in the last 20 years as you might have thought by looking at the collapse in GDP growth rates. So there is a way for China to do this. There is a way for China to rebalance without significant pressure on the household sector. But notice that Japan rebalanced at growth rates of nearly 0%, and my expectation is not 0%, but that a Chinese rebalancing will also come at much lower growth rates. The key, though, is the politics of it. instead of transferring resources from the state sector to the household sector as part of the rebalancing, which would have been the most efficient way of doing it, what we saw in Japan was a transfer of debt from the private sector to the state sector, which is a politically very easy way of handling the transition, but it's economically not a very good way of doing it. So for me, the really big question is, will China be able to rebalance at reasonable growth rates, and more importantly, at reasonable growth rates in household income, first of all? And then secondly, if it does so, is it doing so because it's transferring wealth from the state sector to the private sector, or is it doing so because it's transferring debt from the private sector to the state sector? And like I said, the jury's out. We really don't know. But these are the things that we're going to have to be watching over the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, that's a fascinating parallel. And I'm wondering if it goes further, because Japan had its own malinvestments. You're noting this investment-led growth model. And, of course, one of the big places was in real estate in Japan. And having listened to Jim Chanos at that same conference that we were at, and him talking about where real estate investment has gone in China, and obviously there's been a lot of stories and a lot of press written around that. If the household sector is got a lot of their wealth tied up in Chinese real estate, and if that is in bubble territory or malinvestment, overinvestment, even if their income and wages is rising and or interest payments, other forms of cash-based income are rising, if they follow the Japanese model and we look at their overall wealth and there's a correction in the property bubble, that'll be a countervailing force to this rise in potential consumption from the household sector. How, in your mind, what is the risk in the Chinese real estate sector to this story, and what should we be watching out for there, if anything?
I think there's a significant risk. I mean, I think it's very hard to believe that real estate prices can continue rising. Beijing is a more expensive city than New York, which, when you consider the differences in income, really doesn't make sense. Shanghai is more expensive than New York. But the good news is that most of the real estate seems to be owned by the fairly wealthy. And so if there is a collapse in real estate prices, that hurts the rich more than it hurts the poor and the middle class. And from an economic point of view, that's very important, because the rich consume a very small share of their income, and a reduction in their income shouldn't result in a significant reduction in their consumption. After all, if you go from being worth $500 million to being worth only $200 million, it's not as if you're going to significantly reduce your consumption levels. So that's not going to be a big problem. But for me, you know, real estate gets all the attention because it's very photogenic and it's very easy to understand. But the problem in Japan in the 1980s, and even more so the problem in China today, is not the real estate bubble, it's the infrastructure bubble. China has built out an astonishing amount of infrastructure. And many people think that that's a very good thing. It's great to have lots of infrastructure. Well, it's great to have the right amount of infrastructure. But in the case of China, the quality of the infrastructure far exceeds the productive value of that infrastructure. For example, one of the longest and most beautiful bridges in the world was just built in Qingdao, and I want to go and visit it. It opened quite recently, but I'm told that there's almost no traffic on that bridge. That, to me, is a much bigger waste of money and a much bigger a cost that the Chinese have to bear in the future than empty apartment buildings. So, you know, when interest rates are much too low, we saw this in the United States, you have a tendency to get asset bubbles of all kinds. And we've seen that here. We've seen too much money going into real estate, too much money going into infrastructure, and too much money going into manufacturing capacity. We can produce tons of stuff that the world doesn't need. And that's really the problem that we have here in China. We've spent enormous amounts of money building stuff that whose economic value simply doesn't justify the cost. And we haven't recognized that loss yet. That's all buried in the debt in the banking system. But by hook or by crook, we are going to recognize that loss over the next 10 to 20 years, and we're going to recognize it in the form of much lower GDP growth.
Now, this is absolutely fascinating. I'm wondering if this begins to shed light on something that's been a bit of a mystery to me, and that's the Shanghai Stock Exchange, looking at it here, down roughly a third over the past 2 years. And yet China's had the most robust growth on the global landscape over that time frame. The Shanghai Stock Exchange seems to be very much out of step with its global counterparts, many of which are hitting new highs even as growth limps along out there in the world. Is this story that you've been telling about this investment-led growth finally running into marginal projects, is that what's being reflected in the stock exchange, or is that connecting too many dots? We can't really go there to understand that what's happening.
It is a bit of a puzzle with money pouring into everything. You know, premium teas are at all-time highs. Chinese calligraphy is at all-time highs. Jade is more expensive than gold, the highest quality jade. The prices of everything have gone up, which is what you would expect when there's very, very rapid money growth at incredibly low interest rates. Mm-hmm. Interest rates may have been negative for much of the past decade in real terms. And one of the places money normally shows up is in a booming stock market. I think my own personal opinion is that the stock markets in the United States may be reflecting cheap money far more than they're reflecting fundamental value. And we would have expected that in China. But not that much money has gone into the stock markets. And the reason for that may have been that we sort of had our stock market bubble in the run-up to the Olympics. Mm. Prices went to extraordinary levels. And, you know, it was one of those classic stock market bubble stories where it seemed like everybody in China was playing the stock markets, with all the classic stories that you hear associated with that, you know, cab drivers, et cetera, et cetera. But when the market started coming down, it created enormous consternation among Chinese investors, because there really was a sense that this wasn't supposed to happen, that stock prices should not be coming down, that China's growing quickly, this should go up ever onward. And, of course, that turned out to be wrong. And it seems like the bursting of the bubble in 2009, late 2008 and 2009, was so painful that households have really resisted coming back into the stock market. So it's the only part of the economy that doesn't indicate excess liquidity. Every other part of the economy is showing way too much liquidity. Will that turn around? Probably not, just because the concerns about the Chinese slowdown are so great now, particularly within China, that we're actually much more concerned about money leaving the country than about money inflating a stock market bubble. But you never know. This could continue for another year or so before it corrects, and during that time we may see money start finally flowing into the stock markets. But Chinese households were really badly burned by the last bubble, so they're probably going to be reluctant to come in for quite a while.
Fascinating. I'm wondering if you can shed some light then on another asset class. You mentioned calligraphy's way up, jade's way up. It was more expensive than gold in some cases for higher quality jade. I want to talk about gold for a minute, because I've been absolutely astounded by the import tonnage that's been coming in to China as reflected through the Hong Kong exchange that exists there. Are households the drivers of this fascination with gold and all this importing? Is that perhaps, are they viewing it as a, let's say, a better, safer asset class than stocks at this point in time? And is that a measure of this liquidity as well?
I suspect so. With the price of everything soaring, anything that retains value, the price has gone up. It's probably not a surprise that that a lot of Chinese think that gold might retain value, and so they're buying that. So, it's very interesting to try to figure out what will happen next. I'm not really a gold expert, but I did notice that in next door Vietnam, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, when the financial sector first started getting into serious trouble, there was a brief period, a 6-month period, in which Vietnam, one of the smallest economies in the world, was actually the world's number one trader of gold bullion. And my reasons for thinking that, I suspect, and it's probably not very controversial, is that as the banking system got into trouble, Vietnamese fled into gold as a way of protecting their savings. So could that happen in China? It could. We might see, if there is more weakness in the financial sector, money flowing into gold. But I suspect that it won't be anywhere near the extent that it was in the case of Vietnam, simply because as long as the government is credible, and I think the government has tremendous credibility among Chinese people, then the implicit guarantee of the banking system suggests that the Chinese won't be in a panic to take money out of the banks. If they ever are, I suspect a lot of that will go into gold, silver, and anything else that retains value. But I do think that credibility still is quite high, so I don't see any near rush for the doors. But certainly the Chinese are buying everything, Chinese artists, antique furniture, everything that retains value is being eagerly sought after by middle-class and upper-class Chinese.
Interesting. The final question here then relates to the value of their currency itself, and there's been a lot of talk back and forth about the yuan becoming a next player in the world reserve currency landscape. I know that China set up bilateral trade agreements so that they can do direct currency transfers with certain trading partners. Obviously, China's moving to integrate more with the world currency system. What are the chances of that really happening, and what needs to happen in order for China to actually become a reserve currency?
There's so much hype and nonsense about that that it's a little bit hard sometimes to disentangle it all. But, you know, it was only 20 years ago when you would have had to have been a complete and total idiot not to know that the Japanese yen was going to become the dominant reserve currency. And, of course, that never happened. And the renminbi, the yuan in China, is even less likely than the yen, I think, to become the dominant reserve currency or even a major reserve currency. And the reason is, first of all, there's been tremendous growth in the use of the yuan in international trade, but it's grown from a tiny base. Remember that China is the second largest economy in the world, and it may very well be the largest. It may have overtaken the U.S. as the largest trading nation in the world. And yet, the yuan is not among the top 10 most actively traded currencies in the world. Last time I looked, it was something like 14, which is tiny, tiny, tiny. It's negligible. You won't see any of the top 5, 6, 7 economies of the world whose currencies are not also among the at least the top 5 or top 10 currencies traded. The exception is China, the number 2 economy with a barely traded currency. And so people say, fine, it's not actively traded, but it's growing very, very quickly, and the government wants it to grow very quickly, so it must. Well, not necessarily. It's very hard to have an internationally traded currency. And by the way, it's not a good thing. I actually, in my latest book, I refer to the so-called exorbitant privilege of the dollar as actually an exorbitant burden. Because if your currency is the dominant reserve currency, it means that any time a country wants to turbocharge growth, it actively accumulates your currency, thus running a current account surplus against the U.S. current account deficit. A reserve currency needs to be able to accept those kind of pressures, and I don't think China would ever be willing to accept that. But more importantly, most monetary economists will tell you that open capital controls, that is, the complete freedom of money to move in and out of China, which is a prerequisite if it's going to be a dominant trading or reserve currency, is a very, very risky factor, particularly for a developing country whose financial system is not very flexible and robust. And China's financial system is neither flexible nor robust. It may even be insolvent. So is China eager to allow massive inflows and outflows of capital that could destabilize the banking system? Probably not. They shouldn't want to do that. So why all of this talk? Part of it is probably because most people simply don't understand what it means, and they think having the dominant reserve currency is like having a very large flag. It's a nice thing, and it generates tremendous pride. I think not. I think it's a huge cost. But more importantly, the argument within Beijing is that the central bank and the reformers have been pushing for the internationalization of the renminbi as a backdoor strategy to force domestic financial reform. There has been very little domestic financial reform, and many of the reformers are frankly quite despairing of the ability to reform the financial sector. So that may be the case. A lot of this talk may really be aimed at domestic reforms rather than a real appraisal of the role of the renminbi in the future.
Well, one of the things that obviously needs to get reformed at some point is the just extraordinary foreign exchange reserves that China has built up. How does China go about spending those if it's got fundamentally it's locked out of being a reserve currency at this point in time for a variety of structural reasons? How would it go about spending those foreign exchange reserves without its currency floating? I'm missing the mechanism there.
It's important to remember that whether or not the renminbi, the yuan, is a reserve currency, it's the only reserve currency that the Chinese central bank cannot invest in. By definition, foreign currency reserves are foreign currency. The United States, for example, doesn't have any dollar reserves. That would be meaningless. All of the U.S. reserves are in non-dollar currencies, mainly the euro and the yen, I would guess. So it doesn't really matter whether the renminbi, the yuan, is a reserve currency as far as the management of the reserves would go. China has probably the biggest hoard of reserves as a share of global GDP ever recorded. The only competition with China might have been the United States in the late 1920s, when it too jacked up enormous amounts of reserves. The only other country with equivalent amounts of reserves was probably Japan in the late 1980s. And as I point out these previous cases, you'll notice that in both cases, in the cases of Japan and the United States, having enormous reserves turned out not to be a sign of ruddy good health. Mm-hmm. It was actually a sign of tremendous fragility. The subsequent decade for both the United States and Japan, after the reserves peaked out, turned out to be really horrible decades. And that's probably not a coincidence. The reserves are the consequence of policies aimed at generating tremendous current account surpluses, which also had the impact of generating tremendous capital inflows. So the reserves are simply the balancing component. If you have money coming in through the current account and you have money coming in through the capital account, then it must leave in some form, and the way that it leaves is in the form of reserve accumulation. And in order to buy those reserves, they're not a gift, they're not given to the central bank. The central bank has to buy them. So in order to buy them, it has to create either money or borrow the money by creating central bank bills. So just as in the case of the United States in the 1920s or Japan in the 1980s, the surge in reserves was the flip side of a surge in domestic money supply. It's not a coincidence that all three countries, the United States in the 20s, Japan in the 80s, and China today, had asset price bubbles, massive overinvestments, and surging debt. I think those are things that come together. The accumulation of reserves is simply the flip side of excessively rapid monetary expansion, and we know what the consequences of excessively rapid monetary expansion are: asset bubbles, overinvestment, and ultimately a difficult adjustment. So I think everything is pointing in the same direction. We're going to have quite a difficult adjustment for China as it comes to term with all of this money creation.
I think that sounds absolutely spot on. These imbalances build. It's a tricky proposition to get out of. There's a lot of political realities, social realities, economic realities. Somehow managing all of those has proven difficult in the past. So that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you today, particularly to get that macro view, because I think that's the clearest, easiest way to understand the current situation and what's likely to happen. And your clarity on this is just absolutely astounding. I really want to thank you so much for your time today, because
thank you very much.
It's just fabulous to talk with somebody who's got this just so crisply articulated and formulated. So, Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.